Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Oh, should we go down there? It looks really sweet. This little grove.
Do you know, it looks very us, Katie.
Doesn't it? You're right, it looks very us.
It does, because it's not too boisterous.
It looks like the front cover of a self-help book.
This week on Walking the Dog, I took Ray for a stroll in Peckham with actor, writer and comedian Katie Wicks. Katie grew up with Labradors, so I didn't know what she'd make of my strange Ewok Raymond, but it turned out to be a match made in heaven. I was so excited to meet Katie, as I've been a fan of hers for years, but I was especially excited to chat to her about the forthcoming series of Stathlet's Flats, in which she plays the utterly hilarious Carol. It's honestly the best depiction of a nightmare work colleague you'll ever see. We also chatted about Katie's wonderful book, Delicacy, which I really urge you to read. It's such an honest and just beautifully written memoir, which touches on a lot of the stuff we talked about. Her childhood in Wales, her ongoing journey really towards self-acceptance, and it also documents the multiple losses she went through not long ago and the legacy that's left. And just like Katie, it's sensitive and thoughtful, but it's also really funny because Katie just has funny bones. She's incapable of not being hilarious. As you've probably worked out, I loved this woman and so did Ray. We're officially friends now, whether she likes it or not. Please do check out Series 3 of Stathlet's Flats later this month on Channel 4, and also do read Delicacy. You won't regret it. I really hope you enjoy our chat. I'll shut up now. Here's Katie and Raymond. Where are we going to go, by the way, Katie?
Oh, yes. So Peckham Rye is the nice park area, and it's kind of straight up there.
Lovely.
For, I don't know, about 6 minutes or something. So I live really far up there, but I'm in a hotel because my boiler broke. So I've had no heating or hot water. So I've had to stay in a hotel in Greenwich for two nights. And it happened on... I can't remember what night it happened anyway, but it was quite late. And I thought, oh, sod this, I'm not going to be able to sleep in this temperature. So the only hotel I could find was basically sort of like within the O2 arena. So I'm staying in a really weird hotel in Greenwich.
It's like you're like a backing dancer for boys.
It's like I've got to limber up for Take That at like 5 a.m. every day or something. Yeah, it's just up here. It might be a longer walk than I...
Oh, don't worry.
...than I have in my head.
Well, I was going to put Raymond down, but he's such a slow walker, Katie. I might wait until we get him to the park because he takes so long. He treats walking like he's sort of on Oxford Street looking at clothes.
He does have a very regal vibe.
Oh, look, this is a proper dog.
He's like a small emperor that doesn't want to exert himself. That's the vibe I get off Raymond. We always had black Labradors.
Oh, did you?
Growing up. Yeah, so I'm very much a dog person. But sadly, it's not very practical for me to have one in London, you know what it's like.
There's a doggy.
Yeah, tell me the origin of Raymond.
So the story of Raymond, I like him, Katie. You know those dogs that look a bit like they could be named Whitesnake or something, like heavy metal hair?
Yeah, I mean, that's just like the Dimitri's dog. Dogs are just like that.
This is, oh yeah, Jamie Dimitri, who's been on this podcast, who's your Stathlet's Flats colleague.
We've just finished series 3 and, oh my God, it's the best, yeah. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with it. This isn't bad. I've never been so obsessed with anything I've been involved with, like a fan. I'm such a uber fan. It's such a relief to be in something you actually find funny. There's been many times I've just taken the money and, you know, made huge artistic compromises. So
it's so good. Well, I want to talk loads about that. But, I'm going to introduce it formally, but I might wait until we get into the grass.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sound like I'm walking you Alan Partridge style on the motorway.
Katie. Like, where are they? We've come to the M25 today to walk around.
wearing driving gloves as we walk on the dual carriageway. Come on, Ray, cross the road.
Oh God, the way my mum used to speak to the dogs, it's so funny. Because I do it with my brother's dogs. He has the same dogs now as we had when we were little, so he's trying to sort of carry on the legacy. One of them just died, actually, and the other one, you can imagine, is in like deep mourning, and it's awful to see animals. But also, I'm sorry, I should say this, but also when there was mourning going on in the house, the dogs were so sensitive to it. They were unbelievable. The amount of times, and I, with my brother's dogs, I didn't really have a particularly special bond with them, but the amount of times they would just come and check on me if I was crying, or they'd clamber up on me, at night on the bed. They were really sensitive to it, particularly one of them.
They really are, you know. I think they really pick up on moods, don't they, in oceans. She looks very cool.
It's cool, like a plat, a see-through Mac. Yeah. And your own music just blasting out.
I love the fact
it's like being in Brooklyn, for God's sake.
And I like that bikes have become cool, even though I'm too frightened to ride them.
Oh, yeah, I'm shit at riding bikes.
I can't ride it, really.
No, I can't, really.
I spent years lying, even with friends as an adult, Katie.
I thought you were going to say even with stabilisers.
Come on, Ray. Let's walk with Katie.
Yeah. So this was the main park I'd come to during lockdown when we were allowed our hour out, because I don't have a garden, sadly.
And it's Peckham Rye.
Yeah, but it got, you can imagine it, you know, it was so densely populated that it didn't really feel like you were in an outdoor space, and you couldn't really socially distance very easily. Oh, look at Raymond in action. Good to see his full flow.
You say in action, Katie. he looks like a centipede, doesn't he?
he does have like, his bum looks like his front a little bit, which I like as well.
So I'm going to formally introduce you.
Yes.
I'm so thrilled. I'm Peckham.
Thrilled.
And I'm with the very wonderful Katie Wicks. And I'm introducing her to my dog, Raymond. What do you think so far?
Hi, Raymond. Yeah, I mean, I love that we have the same sort of hair. Raymond.
Do you... Talk me through your history with dogs then. You don't have a dog.
Yeah, no, it's... I mean, I'd love to, but it's just a bit impractical. It's so many things, I think. It's like, you know, living in a flat, not having outdoor space, being self-employed, it feels like you can't make a plan sort of week to week. Because, you know, everything just... You know, I could suddenly get an email on saying you have to go to such and such on certain days. So that... I don't know. I feel like it would make me too anxious to have one.
Yeah.
As much as I'd love one, as much as it would calm me down. But I grew up with dogs. We always had dogs. Like, some of my earliest memories are the dogs we had. And, always black Labradors. And there was one in particular. We had four, I think, because there's two that died and then another one. And there was two black Labradors called Hattie. Hattie was amazing. She had such an extraordinary temperament. I've never known a dog like it. And I don't know whether she just kind of imbued the energy of the females in the family. She was very gentle, very intelligent, really sort of knew what was going on, and just very sort of human-like. And she was kind of very, yeah... Just a really, she never barked, like never ever once heard her bark. It was really,
really
surprising. And then we adopted, I mean, this is in a way a whole kind of nature versus nurture debate, because we adopted another dog which had been abandoned in a quarry. And this dog just never got over it. It was, you know, even after sort of 10 years of being in this loving family and, you know, being given all the security, it just never ever really could trust, or its nervous system just never recovered, I think, from just like the noises of the quarry and stuff. So it was quite interesting to see this played out, how trauma, you know, what plays through your life in these two dogs. And then one of my siblings has also now two black Labradors, and as I was saying, which one of them just died, and to see the other one in full mourning is heartbreaking.
Oh, do you think they really... Can you tell that they sense?
Yeah, I
the
mean,
loss.
I don't see them every day, but from it's really clear that the other dog is very confused why there's this absence and thrown and kind of making this pining noise on the spot where the other dog used to sleep. Oh, wow, quite a sort of posh-looking dog, like an aristocratic-looking dog has come over.
What are you saying about Ray, Katie? You're saying that dog is slumming it?
Ray's just not moving. So funny.
Ray does a weird thing. He sort of freezes. Oh, I don't know whether it's social
like
anxiety.
Response. Yeah, I really relate. This other dog's so confident, and it's got like a pink ribbon around its middle. Sort of looks like a sort of like a gift from Harrods or something, doesn't it? It's really fluffed up.
It's kind of like a Spitz. It's that Pomeranian colour, I think. It's a Spitz or something. But yeah,
I think I only know about Labradors because that's the only dog we ever had, and now it's like continued as a tradition. I mean, it's very much like they're very like they're all pack dogs, aren't they? My main memory is that the dog just always had to be where someone was, always in on the action. So my mum was really, you know, into dog training. What was she called, that woman that everyone was it the sort of boss?
Barbara Woodhouse.
Yeah. I remember her sort of talking about her, and she did a pretty good job. That these dogs were pretty. I think if anything, they were a little too obedient. It kind of worried me that they'd been sort of brutalised into behaving.
So, you grew up with your Labradors,
yeah,
and your family, and this was in Wales.
Yeah, it was it was like a sort of village outside of, just half an hour outside of Cardiff, I guess.
Tell me about your mum and your dad.
Well, they met in the 70s, I guess. They went to drama school in Birmingham. And my dad was, like, from, you know, like a really poor area in, like, sort of near Swansea. And mum was a bit more sort of middle class. So I think even like my mum's parents didn't like approve of their relationship, and they sort of ran off and got married in secret. And they acted for a bit. They were both really funny, and I never really got to see them act, but like, I think they would have really made, you know, amazing actors.
Why didn't they act?
Oh, because they had kids. And
yeah,
they moved back home to Cardiff and had to get normal jobs. And how was that? Dream over.
Yeah.
So it's not like, someone asked me the other day whether when I said they were actors, someone had like, I mean, they were actors for, you know, a couple of years or whatever. But
yeah,
someone asked me the other day if they sort of helped me, and it was like laughable. It wasn't that kind of thing. It wasn't like, the Redgrave dynasty. Like, no, definitely not. You know, we weren't sort of wealthy. They didn't have like connections or anything. They went sort of backstage, and sort of my dad worked backstage in a theatre then for the rest of his life, and my mum like started a dance company that's still going. So they were really, my whole family were all creative and you know, artistic. So in some ways they were really understanding when I sort of said, look, I want to, you know, write and perform and stuff. I think they put me off only because they knew how hard it was. And I think maybe they expected me to fail, which is no reflection of, you know, what they thought of me, but I think they just thought it's really tough. So when I didn't, they were kind of, particularly my mum was, you know, was living vicariously a little through my success, which is fine, but never in a way that felt, you know, problematic. And they were very much, you know, still in love and together till the end. In fact, my dad went first, and I think my mum got her cancer diagnosis 9 days after dad died.
Cool.
Which was just hell, obviously. But I think that he had dementia, and she looked after him for so long that she made herself ill.
Yeah.
So really it was kind of the price of love that finished her off in many ways. It was really difficult because we could sort of see that he was struggling, but I think she was kind of keeping it from people because she didn't want to put him in a home. I think because it can be, I think people go downhill quite quickly sometimes, which isn't a criticism of those places, but I think it's just
Yeah.
It's just what happens, isn't it? And I think it's almost the lack of responsibility or stimulus or having to sort of attempt to be normal. But in the end, you know, social services had to get involved and they just sort of said, you know, Dad had nearly set fire to the house again. Mum was starting to get ill. She could barely move. So it was just a disaster, really.
And this was literally only a couple of years ago, really.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
I've had like three major deaths in like 3 years, pretty much, starting in 2017. So yeah, it just went bang, bang, bang. So yeah, it is still quite recent with them all. But yeah, like I think I'm sort of surprised how functional I am, even though it's only been sort of 2.5 years since the last one.
It changes you forever, doesn't it?
But yeah, I think it's just dealing with one death would be bad enough, but I think that was the most difficult aspect, I think. I felt like my brain couldn't take it in. It was too much too soon. Oh, yeah. Look at this little sausage dog. And I think, and also with my best friend, that was the first death. It was the suddenness of it. And so it was really the shock. I had to deal with the shock before I even got to the grief, I'd say. That was about 6 months of dealing with that. And I've never really understood shock in that, like, almost like a medical sense before, where your brain cannot, you simply can't function. It's like you've been completely short-circuited, and that was very...
You're definitely in the learning phase, I
apologise. Oh, don't worry, my dog's never made it out of the learning phase, which is why he's on the lead.
Never made it out. And that, I'd never really experienced that before, because with my parents, there was at least some preparation, but even with preparation, it's still incredibly shocking, profoundly surreal experience that someone was living and then they weren't. But yeah, with my friend, it was really violent, and what happened, and that was, yeah, I don't even know. There's some days I don't even know who I'm grieving and at what pace, and in some ways I've had to shut what happened to my friend away quite quickly because suddenly I had to be a carer. So I don't know. Do you think you've still got sort of things to deal with that you haven't?
I feel like grief needs space and it needs time.
Yeah.
And when you lose a lot of people, as you did, in one go like that, you're robbed of time, and that can be quite difficult because it interrupts the natural process.
Yeah, I think.
So that is really important that your friends and people you work with and people who care about you, they sort of know that, you know, it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It doesn't mean you won't be fine on a day-to-day level. But the thing I found hard was sometimes people would say, what's wrong?
Yeah.
And I sort of think, because I'd burst into tears.
Yeah.
At the slightest thing. And I just learned to accept that after a while. I thought, oh, no, I just cry a lot now and I feel very deeply.
Yeah, I think there's crying I recognise as grief crying now, which I never really sort of had before. And it's a completely different type of crying where I'd almost have to wait till everyone had gone out because the noises I would make were so intense, and it comes right from the belly. And I mean, I guess it's like wailing. And I did plenty of wailing, but, you know, I'd kind of do it into pillows. I remember reading an article about a guy who used to drive somewhere in his car on his own so he could properly wail for sort of half an hour. And I think I did that once in a hotel room, but even then I was like trying to mute, you know, I was trying to keep the sound down. But I would always feel better after the wail. It's so sort of such an innate noise. But also I think it still manifests itself in quite weird ways, I think. That's the thing I wish I'd known, that there's this whole menu of stuff to choose from, which is not just sort of feeling sad or missing the person. It, like, you know, all the physical symptoms I had to do with stress and grief, anxiety. Sometimes it was more like a panic attack than anything, or being obsessed with something else to try and distract myself. And also I'm still not good with silences, and I used to be like a really good meditator and was really into it, and now I'm like, God, it's a real emotional privilege to be able to meditate. I'm not ready yet because I can't face that much reflection all at once.
Yes.
So I'm always sort of filling the day with noise, and I'm still doing that, and that's definitely a hangover.
Yeah.
From some of the images I have in my head, like flashbacks.
I know it's tough though, because people are so brilliant, and I think people are luckily understanding more and more, you know, about loss. And I want to talk a bit more about your childhood as well, because I've just read your absolutely brilliant book.
Oh, thank you.
Delicacy. I really urge people to read it, because
thank you. I try very hard. I mean, it's the most I've ever worked on anything in my life. It nearly killed me. I feel like I was going to have a breakdown writing that.
I tried very hard.
I did.
The last time I heard someone say that was when someone congratulated Jürgen Klinsmann for being nice about the England team during the lot. And he went, thank you, I tried very hard. But Delicacy is essentially, it's really interesting because you use the theme of cake within it in a sort of Proustian way, I'm going to say.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I'd never finished it, but I read the first book. But yeah, the cake is this kind of, it's sort of scaffolding, really. And very quickly, I just, should we go down there? It looks really sweet, this little grove.
Do you know, it looks very us, Katie.
Doesn't it? Right, it looks very us.
It does, because it's not too boisterous.
No, it looks like the front cover of a self-help book. about your path to loss or something.
The road less traveled until these two cackling extroverts turned up.
I had all these kind of moments, stories I wanted to write about, and I didn't know how to collect them all together. I knew I didn't want it to be the normal kind of memoir, and really it has nothing to do with TV or anything. That's like deliberately left out, because I just thought that was kind of the least interesting thing to me. And also really quickly I realised I had total creative freedom, and I wanted to try and, you know, write something that was a little more poetic and thoughtful, which I've wanted to do for so long, but I haven't really had the confidence to say, this is me, this is what I like. Because you don't always get an opportunity to do that if you're trying to just, you know, get a TV script made or whatever, it's just a different, you know, approach to writing. One's not better than the other. But I wanted to, like, prose allowed me to, yeah, just go into a deep kind of reflection about it all. Kate was this, emerged as a kind of theme. And I sort of worried it was a bit twee, and perhaps it's like almost misleading that you don't think the book will have the darkness that it has. But then it sort of became like almost writing against the kind of sweetness of cake. I wanted it to very quickly be about how I kind of hate it. Cake is a sort of ultra femme, slightly patronising, like fluffy object that always seemed to be there when actually there was something really painful happening. And
you know, I know this sounds ridiculous, but I was watching Married at First Sight the other day.
The UK one?
Yeah.
I've only watched the Australian one, which I absolutely fucking loved.
The Australians deliver more on the bad behaviour.
Amazing.
You know what was interesting? They had, the boys had a dinner party and then the girls did. And it really struck me, Katie, that the men had these platters with meat and cheese on it. And the women had cupcakes and glasses of pink champagne.
And I thought, awful.
I like That's the awful. Platters. Yeah, yeah. I don't want to eat cake it's and like, champagne because I'll throw up and be lightheaded. I'd like meat.
Yeah, I'd like the cheese.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, actually I think this was in the book at one point, and then I took it out because there was no obvious place for it. But I've, my group of two, three really close female friends, they're quite sort of unconventional. They're quite alpha women in some ways. And one of them's actually non-binary. But whenever we're in a group on our own, and maybe we're talking about something, you know, fascinating or to do with feminism or something, a waiter will always come over and sort of say, hi, ladies, do you want a cocktail or something? And we'll always, like, look at, like, you know, it's really sort of patronising, like we're in an episode of Sex and the City, and I always want to think, like, well, you wouldn't say that to a group of men.
Yeah.
You wouldn't offer us, like, you know, I don't know, it's really bizarre to suddenly go, oh, we were just talking as, like, you know, a group of people, and suddenly we sort of forget that we've been, like, gendered and then have this sort of thing projected onto us where we were just talking about, we were just having a nice time talking.
So your brilliant book talks about your childhood, and I want to go back again, back in time to Wales, and what sort of a child you were growing up.
Well, I was, I think the main, the word that was always on all school reports was sensitive. It was just always the thing it came back to. I remember my school reports were all like, not that, you know, it's funny that my mind first went to school reports as if that's any indication of what you're like, but... I remember it was very sort of like, it's quiet, sensitive, kind of thorough, thoughtful, shit at PE. That was always like the vibe that kind of followed me around. You know, could spend hours in a creative task, really happy, had a really rich fantasy life from the off, total kind of dreamlike state. And I was incredibly shy. I'd have a sort of selective mutism where I wouldn't like to speak outside of the house. And I had it until about maybe 5 years ago, where I'd suddenly get this like flash of like intense self-consciousness and would stop speaking. And I've had to really just grow out of it and fight it. But I'd get this kind of, just this kind of shutting down. I've always had this, talking to us. I've always had this, this kind of weird shutdown thing that I do. Which has stopped, but it's taken a long time, I think. I'm just building up my resilience to whatever shame is going on. I was like, I think I was quiet, had quite an even temperament. And I just remember the world was a very confusing, strange place. But it was just very sort of creative.
And you were close to your folks?
We were really, really close, really close. And my dad didn't really like people visiting. He was like really, I think had quite a lot of shame himself. And... he didn't really like people. You know, his dream would be to sort of live on a cliff in the middle of nowhere. And my mum was incredibly social and sort of charming. But they were both very funny, very funny. All my family are funny. So I thought it was completely normal. And I'd go to other people's houses and stuff and I'd be like, their mum wasn't very funny. Like, that's weird. It's like I've heard Amy Winehouse say that... She just thought everyone sang because her family sang. It was like that, but just being really sort of entertaining. So in some ways, I don't really value being funny because I think it's like... I sort of think it's not even anything... I just think it's like genetic. I just think it's...
Yeah.
It's in my DNA. Like, I don't get that excited when people say, I think you're funny. Like, some people I really see, they desperately need...
Yes, I see that.
That. And of course, it's nice. It's powerful. It's like a power to have. It was my first taste of power was being funny. Absolutely. If I didn't have it, then what the hell I'd do? But I think because it was just part of my family, I sort of... And also, they had a sort of slightly different public way to they were at home. So I would sort of associate being funny with almost being a bit people-pleasy and... almost with my mum sometimes almost out of anxiety she would sort of go into this really funny mode which would be so funny and disarming, and I did it throughout my 20s definitely. Whenever I got nervous I would just start like monologuing and like before. So now I slightly, you know, all those years of therapy on where I'm sort of being this real authentic person all the time, and I think I've gone the other way and I've got really unfunny, which is a shame. Real shame.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I think you articulated in your book how I think I probably felt without even realising it. You know, until I read your book, that all these moments, and I'm sure a lot of women experience that, you sort of thought, oh my God, yes, that happened to me and that happened to me. And,
yeah. To do with our bodies.
To do with, yeah. To do with just this strange internal shame that you carry around.
Yeah.
From a really young age.
Yeah, it's sadly such a sort of normal part of the female experience, isn't it? Yeah, I think I had this sense, well, I didn't realise till I think I was much older. And then when the chapter that I briefly write about consent, I think the reason I, and it's not like a great sort of, you know, essay, it's just, it was a way to try and articulate that I think if you've grown up and been fat shamed from a young age and been, what's the word, like objectified from a young age, I had this really strong sense that my body wasn't really mine. That was the message I wanted to get across. So then I think in my 20s, if I found myself in a situation with a man, I didn't know how to advocate for my body or for what I wanted or didn't want. And I think that's directly linked to having been fat shamed. And I just thought it was interesting because there's an amazing book Aubrey Gordon wrote, which is a lot more looking at the relationship between fat and consent. And I thought, yeah, that's really interesting. It's definitely part of, in the mix of, I mean, well, you know, without sort of victim blaming, but it's definitely in the mix of having a body that you think is worthy to stand up for. Yeah. And it definitely, you know, I've been so many different sizes, and I've undereaten and overeaten, and finally I think I've conquered it through a lot of like hard work and therapy. But that set up a relationship, food in my body, definitely. I think I was about 7 when I was first fat shamed, and it's really hard. I remember absorbing that message so deeply, and I think I have to fight it every day to just get to a kind of, I don't know, average level of self-esteem. But it's tricky because I also have days where I think, oh, I don't want to fall into that sort of boring sort of female paradigm of, oh, we all hate our bodies, and I don't like join in with conversations anymore where people are sort of going, oh God, I hate my thighs, and then someone goes, yeah, me too. Like I don't do it because I can't speak to my body like that.
Do you feel sometimes, my similar thing, I would find women talking about getting older.
Yeah,
and how they look terrible, and I look so old. I've refused to join in those conversations
now.
Yeah,
that's great.
And I knew the message was, it's not right for you to be okay. You're breaking the rules.
Yeah, yes. And when I gave up trying to change my body, I think it was breaking the rules. It was like a huge taboo that I'm not trying to improve it or change it. I'm just trying to be.
Oh,
is this a little child? Like, his dad is saying, please don't get in the mud.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
That's my dog. Do you like him? He's a bit silly, isn't he? Do you like him? Not sure. I know. He's a grower, I promise. Nice to meet you.
Oh, dear.
Thank you. Oh, it's okay.
Is that for the dog?
Oh. I think he was throwing the bread at the dog. I think.
He threw the bread down in some sort of protest.
Should we sit here?
It's so nice walking and talking. It's one of my favourite things to do with friends, you know.
That's some of my banana bread.
Oh, I've got that ball of...
Oh, did I give you the ball?
Cacao.
I bought Katie the cacao and we'll give her a treat.
I got into trouble for eating on a podcast, though. People were like, about seven people complained.
Oh, God.
I was eating a carrot.
Look at this, Katie. I'll give her a treat. Come on. So tell me, were you quite academic? Were you popular?
I was. I knew I was bright. I got very overwhelmed in lessons. There was a lot of anxiety and I didn't always listen. And like I did the whole thing, got good A levels, went to uni. So I was more academic than my brother. But then also in my group of friends, I think I was the only one who didn't go to Oxbridge. So I think compared to them, I felt like I'd fucked it. I had such anxiety from such a young age and I just didn't listen. I was kind of overwhelmed and I went to the comp down the road. You know, it's big classes, like 32 or whatever. And I think if I'd gone to, you know, in different circumstances, I think I would have been helped and coached a bit more. But I remember just finding it overwhelming to take in the information somehow. I never really know what that was about. And it's funny, like I started having guitar lessons in lockdown and I really, really loved it. But I really reverted back to how I was in school. I would feel myself get the teacher, I'm like reading music and he is going into all the sort of music theory stuff, which is really complex. And I would feel myself get this kind of that weird anxiety and I just stopped listening. So I don't know what that's about, but I suddenly realised that if I'd voiced that, then maybe I would have got help with that. It was like all the noise and the boys behind me making. I just remember that it wasn't like an environment where you felt like you could pay attention. And because I was the first person to go to university from my family, it didn't feel like that anybody was really good at sort of, you know, helping with homework. They were bright in their own way, I think, but they hadn't like gone to uni or anything. So
there wasn't that sort of academic structure at home.
Yeah, where... I think I did pretty well. I knew that I understood things, but I wasn't, you know, I was just kind of off in a daydream a lot of the time. I was very good at fitting in. I just like chameleon like would kind of fit in, but I had like a really, I think by sort of sixth form, I had my like core group that I'm still kind of friends with, and it was all great. That was like a really good time. But I think I wasn't really funny till I was about 15.
Really?
I think I didn't really speak much. No, I was just really overwhelmed. I mean, I remember feeling like we were a bit different because of what my parents did and stuff, I guess it just felt different because, like, in the evening after school and stuff, like, I'd go with my mum to the theatre where Dad worked and we'd, like, wait by stage door. And it's still there in Cardiff now, this big theatre. And I'd get to meet, like, these kind of random celebs at stage door. I'd be, like, 7 or 8 and they'd, like, you know, ruffle my hair and talk to me. And I remember sort of thinking it was a weird thing the next day when people would be like, "What? You know, I watched EastEnders." I'd almost feel a bit weird about it. I'd be like, oh, I met, you know, Peter Andre, whoever it was. And I sort of like sat in a lighting box and was allowed to press this button that made the stage go a different colour or whatever it was. And also I remember because my mum worked for this dance company. So a lot of, instead of babysitting, I'd have to sit in rehearsals and watch these like, it was like a contemporary dance company. So it was very kind of like, you know, quite avant-garde. So again, it just felt really different, you know, and weird. And the school was like pretty rough. And I just remember sort of feeling like I had to fit in and I had like a stronger accent. I don't have it now at all, but I sounded more like Charlotte Church and just tried to seem like normal, you know, and not draw attention to yourself. And there was definitely a culture almost of don't look like you're trying too hard or you'd be called a swot. So I think even that was part of it.
that I didn't ever put my hand up in class and say what the answer was, even if I knew it.
There's a bit in the book, Katie, which where you tell a joke and you interrupt this...
Oh, that, yeah.
You interrupt a guy's punchline, and it's a fascinating moment because it's about, to me, it was about you... It's sort of identifying or realising that you were funnier than this guy, this middle-aged guy.
Because some of my... We had to go to... my grandfather was not a very nice man, and he had these big sort of army dues that we had to go to, and I always hated it. I really resented it. But also, I really loved writing about that age of just when you're about to feel like a woman, that kind of 13, 14 years old. And what I remember about it is that having to go to this sort of party in a big lawn, and there being just so many men there, because it's like an army thing, and feeling suddenly, you know, I was in this kind of posh dress that was slightly shorter than and tighter than I was used to. And I remember it being a bit of a thing with my mum, that she really wasn't sure if I should wear such an adult dress. And I just remember instantly feeling like the male gaze and feeling so self-conscious. And it was the first time I sort of felt the energy of men look at me, and that I was old enough to be, you know, considered like sexually attractive. And I remember it just being a huge moment, and it feeling very sort of overwhelming. And sometimes it would sort of be, I felt like men were looking at me like, oh, are you old enough to fancy, yes or no? You know, I was so just at that kind of age of and just how uncomfortable but also thrilling it was, exhilarating feeling. But then also at the same time, you know, constant criticism of my body. So it was very sort of confusing of like, well, you know, some people want it clearly, but also at the same time, other women usually saying, oh, you know, you're too big or whatever, or you don't want to get any bigger, or you have such a nice face, if you just lost some weight, you know. But also looking back, you know, the irony is, it's obviously not about size, but I wasn't even big. So and this is a sort of posh old man who was sort of holding court and being horrible to his wife, and he started telling this joke, and I suddenly thought, oh, I know this joke, I've heard it. So I just said it, I just said the punchline. I didn't know what I was doing, and he was furious. And then, there was a moment I was by the toilets, and he just, I mean, I really exaggerated it for like comic effect in the book, but he, you know, he said to me, never ever interrupt your elders, young lady, again. And he was furious, and I thought maybe he was going to hit me or something. I mean, it was really scary. I don't think he was, but that's how it felt. And I remember like running away and just thinking, oh my God, like, this is, what have I done? This is like a superpower. You know, he was so angry. I kind of thought I was helping, I think. I think it was like, oh yeah, don't worry, I'll say it. And I was just so relieved to be able to contribute. And I was at the grown-up table, and I was, you know, 13, and I was like, oh, I know this joke. But he was furious, and I sort of joke that's how I got into comedy, which is sort of a joke, but I like the idea that that's how it began.
Did you do drama when you went to university?
Yeah. I went to Warwick, and the course was very... It was quite heavily sort of performance art, live art scene, and I was really into it. And I just... That's what I thought I was going to do. I thought I was going to be like Marina Abramovic. So I don't quite know how I ended up in, like, mainstream comedy, to be honest. But the first Edinburgh shows I did, which were quite weird and anarchic, they absolutely were based in that kind of devising of experimental theatre. Just that, but kind of...
Your dog's ever so sweet. Aww. That's so lovely you've got that to help him.
Yeah.
What happened, if it's okay to ask?
He had a spinal stroke.
Oh, so bless.
Just, the back bit just stopped working. The cord's gone, basically.
Hello.
The spinal cord.
Hello.
He's staring at squirrels. That's why he's got a crazy face on.
Wow. That's ever so lovely.
Oh, thank God the technology exists.
He's
not chasing the dog alive.
Good boy, come on.
God, it's absolutely heartbreaking, isn't it?
Oh, the poor little thing. Oh, yeah, he's a black Labrador, like, and he's got
two legs like suspended.
Yeah.
And a little
he's got the two stabilizers.
She thinks we're staring too much.
Yeah, do you think so? And When did you start feeling that you were getting attention and offers of work? And
from about 25, I've always kind of worked.
Yeah.
I've been really lucky. I mean, I had about 3 years of shit jobs, mostly working in shops. And from about 25, 26, I just was always, you know, writing and creating stuff or in other people's things.
I would like to bring us up to date with your career, because I had Jamie Dimitri on this podcast.
Oh, great.
And
did he bring his dog?
He didn't bring his dog.
By the way, this is from filming. I wouldn't choose this. I just don't have any remover. It's bright, sort of yellow lemon nail varnish. It's all right.
I was thinking it was quite chic.
Well, I did this thing. Do you know the comedian Marwan Rizwan? He painted them yellow. Maybe I asked him to. I don't remember. We were doing this thing together and I suddenly realised it's just coming off. It looks gross.
Can I be honest? I saw the yellow nails. You spoiled it now. Because I thought, it made me think, oh, she's so cool and young and millennial.
Okay.
She's got yellow nails.
I'll take it all back.
And we've met at this very trendy coffee shop in Peckham. She's got the yellow nails.
She's got the yellow nails.
And
on.
I've got remnants of a bit Kate Middleton ballet pink.
and you're holding a small fern.
So Jamie. Staff Let's Flats.
Yeah.
I had Jamie Dimitri on this podcast, and I mean, he's so charming.
Oh, he's, yeah.
But I discovered that show. And I almost couldn't believe how brilliant
it's
it
incredible,
was.
Isn't
and how
it?
Brilliant you are, because Carol is... We all know Carol.
We've all worked with Carol.
We see Carol every day and everything. I mean, as soon as you walked on and I saw the two blonde streaks every time.
Yeah.
You know, when I wake up every day and I do my hair, I think, does it look a bit Carol?
It's so funny you say that, because the third series, we put clip-ins in before we were like... And now they're more prominent, and we had to clear it with the producer and stuff. It's like, is this okay? She's got like an extra streak. I think she's got like maybe a fourth, and it's even more prominent. Yeah, I mean, I just think I'm so proud of it. I just love it. So we're all such good friends. It's such a sort of lovely cliche, but like we all just talk about how lucky we feel. Like, you know, we've all gone off to do other stuff, and we're all just like bereft, and we just know it's not ever going to be the same, because it's like, we've all got the same sense of humour. You know, we're all good friends. I think the episodes are almost too long because we were just improvising so much, and we all just have this chemistry where no one drops like a massive clanger. We just seem to have this kind of language that we understand of the show, and I think this series is the best. Yeah, I think it's bonkers. It's so, so funny. But yeah, it just feels like, I feel so grateful to be in something and actually think, God, this is creative and original and weird and funny. And Jamie said to me, he kept referencing, you know, the Apprentice candidates, which, I mean, I'm obsessed with. So I got it straight away, what he wanted. And just all these sort of people from like 90s reality TV shows we talked about. So I completely got it. It's, you know, I guess it's a bit like The Office, isn't it? It's people who sort of think they're wacky, fascinating, you know. I mean, done with compassion, obviously. We're not punching down or anything. But just also like... Oh, fascinating. But also what I love about it is I think it celebrates... the kind of, you know, everyday weirdness.
Like, yes, yeah.
I think when you hear people speak in real life, people do say really weird things and get words wrong. And, you know, I think real life is more surreal than we imagine when we're trying to write naturalistic dialogue. And I think he captures that really, really well. Just, you know, the fact that Al lives in Birmingham and goes on the coach. Hey,
it's never quite
such a weird guy. Like, who is he and knows Japanese?
I presume Jamie was familiar with you as a performer and wanted you involved.
Well, I gave him his first job, really. So we met... I met him up at the Edinburgh Festival, and he... I think it's 2009, something like that, and we were doing our sketch show, me and Anna Crilly, and we hired him and Tash, his sister, to write on our show. So we gave them their first sort of TV job, and then he was in our sketch show. And I remember thinking, my God, like, this kid's going to, you know, I remember saying to him, like, you're going to employ me one day, mate. This is, you're obscenely talented. I could just see it. And, yeah, he did. So I've known him since, I've known him for, you know, 10-odd years. And yeah, so it was just really exciting to get it, to be able to do it.
It strikes me as quite collaborative.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's terrifying, but in some ways, I think it was that thing of improvising when the stakes are that high, where everyone's being so funny, and you know it's won all these BAFTAs and so on. It does feel like extreme pressure that you're going to have to just sort of say something incredible, which is sort of exhausting and terrifying. But then at the end, the sense of accomplishment. I suddenly realised, God, I haven't actually felt that. I've been in this kind of blasé few years, maybe, of thinking, oh, you know what I'm doing, I'll just turn up and sort of do that silly voice that I'll do, whatever. To suddenly think, oh, God, yeah, this is like the early days. This is like at the beginning when you're adrenalised and it really feels like what you're doing is new and exciting and it matters and you really want to get it right. And I hadn't felt like that in a while. And so it was kind of really exhilarating. It's taken me all this time, but I would love to just carry on making weird comedy for the rest of my life, but you know, I don't know if I can afford to. But I feel really inspired by him that I can, you know, I think it's taken me, it comes back to childhood in many ways, in that I think I'm not very good at saying no to things. Even now I struggle because I don't want people to be disappointed or to upset people, or to have people go, well, who do you think you are that you think you're too good for this thing? But obviously that just makes me miserable, and then I'm the one in it on TV. So I'm the one who ends up looking like I'm advocating for this when I'm not.
Yeah.
And it just makes me resentful. But it's difficult as well, because I also feel so grateful to be working. So I think it's a really tricky balance of being grateful and being sort of humble.
So come here, Raymond. Look, Katie. Katie's laughing at my dog. What do you do to
I really enjoyed that.
I sometimes, when you've been through a really tough time, which I think you're still in yours, to be honest. And you will
God,
be
do
for
I
a
seem
while.
Like that?
No, you don't actually.
this is me on the good day. Although I did have to sleep in the O2. Don't forget. Because my boiler's broken. I did sleep under those big yellow things.
Oh, God. Do you find sometimes, after you've experienced a prolonged grief, my experience was that when I'd laugh, I remember the first time I sort of laughed properly, because it felt like so long since I'd laughed, and I just thought, oh, I've forgotten I could do that.
Yeah, I found that it made me so grateful for small things, and there was a point where, so after the last sort of death and after the last, you know, the admin was out of the way and things had, and I was saying this to my siblings, once things had sort of started to sort of calm down, I think my body was still expecting, you know, the adrenaline was still going and it was still expecting like a phone call to say someone else has died. It was still, it was still expecting, you know, disaster, which is a very kind of post-traumatic way of being, I think, anyway. So I remember that it took about sort of 6 months for my body to really believe that there wasn't something awful coming. I mean, ironically, there was, and I had an operation about, I had to have like major surgery after my mum died 3 months after, which is also pretty traumatic and awful. And a tree fell down in front of my front door and I couldn't get into my house. So things did actually carry on happening weirdly. But I've reached a point now, yeah, where I'm starting to have a nice time again, and I'm really grateful to have these kind of periods of that I feel okay and that I'm not feeling massively triggered and that it's just nice and doing nice things for myself. Yeah, I'm really that it feels really amazing just to go somewhere and not to be glued to my phone or thinking the hospital's going to call, this person's going to call. And I feel very protective of that piece. And it's in some ways it's like my tolerance, it's built my tolerance for everyday stress. But at the same time, it only takes lots of little small things to really tip me over the edge, you know, like the boiler breaking, and suddenly I associate, it's funny, I remember when I went into deep shock, I was so cold all the time, and for some reason when the boiler broke, I was so anxious about being cold, because I associate it with being really traumatised. I don't know why, I just do. So I had a bit of a spin out about, I won't be able to be warm, I won't be able to look after myself, I won't be able to, you know, like these basics, these sort of basic things I have to do to have good mental health, for me include like being warm, fed, you know. So when I can't do that, I get very panicked, because I feel like I've got my sort of self-care down to such a sort of specific, exact thing. I'm so good at it now. Not always, but it's like I have these really basic requirements that if I don't do these things, then I'm going to be in trouble. So it's made life a bit simpler in some ways. That, I mean, I think I said in the book, I mean, there was a day where I just like, you know, had a really good peach. And I just remember thinking, like, this is the only good thing that's going to happen today. But that's okay. You know, I have to go to hospital now, but this peach was good. So it has made me feel very grateful. Because there was a time, when a really dear friend of mine just lost someone very suddenly, really, really horrendous circumstances a few weeks ago. And we are, at the moment, going on these long, out, you know, 3-hour walks, talking. And I can't believe that it's given what happened to me real meaning, because I genuinely can help her. And I don't know about you, but before this happened to me, I wouldn't have known what to have said. And I think some people have been a bit frightened of it and have kind of ignored her. And I've been right there, like, doesn't frighten me at all. Even when she's wailing, I don't feel remotely frightened. And at the same time, it's nothing, you know, it's so ineffable, it's beyond words and all that. But she said to me the other day, she said, you said this and this the other day, and it really, really helped. And I just feel so, like, privileged to be able to be, A, to be well enough to start helping others. I haven't been previously. I've had to be, like, really selfish just to get through it. So the fact that I'm in a place to help others is amazing. And also it really helps me to help her. And I just didn't even realise I had all this sort of... it just gives you this wisdom, doesn't it? It's very specific wisdom. There's like a big rave has just started up.
What's going on with the rave?
Do you want to move again?
I don't mind. We can head back. We'll walk up here. The rave started.
It's like a live band in the park.
Oh, it's James Brown. How did you... Why did you end up in this... lovely part of London?
No, I lived in Brixton for years and years when I was, and it was a real laugh, like, from about, you know, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, it was really fun times being in Brixton. So I just saved up and bought this little flat here. But it's so, my God, like, things go wrong with this place. Every 6 months, something breaks or goes wrong. It's kind of been a bit of a nightmare.
Which way, Katie? That way. I'm following you.
Oh, okay. I actually don't recognise this bit.
Oh, it's all right. Let's go out there. I feel if we're in a clearing, it's like in a movie. When they get lost, they find a clearing and it's all right.
It's a bit Jurassic Park-y, this bit.
But it's squirrels. Really,
it's like, I love my place, but it's really deceptively high maintenance.
Yeah. Hey, are you a perfectionist, Casey?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, no, I am. I mean, I'm obsessive about things, definitely. Like, really, I get totally absorbed and obsessive about things.
Are you someone who thinks, unless I can do it perfectly, I don't want to do this
thing?
Oh,
yeah. That for me, that's why I think the book took so long, because I was honing my taste. I was reading loads, which is what I did before I started writing. It's funny because not when I've been like talking about the book, not people don't often ask me about like the craft of writing. which I love talking about because I feel like I've learned so much and improved so much as a writer.
Mm.
I'm going to Cardiff Uni to talk to the MA students, the creative writing MA students, which is like the thing I'm most excited about more than anything to do with TV at the moment, to just sit in a room and just nerd out about favourite writers and stuff. But anyway, so I sort of read so much to help me sort of work out what my voice was a bit more before entering into it. And the more I would read, you know, incredible writing, I would feel so intimidated.
Mm.
And then what I would write would be so far away from what I knew to be good writing that I'd sort of give up. So it was like the more I knew, the more my taste improved and my awareness of good writing improved, the shitter I would feel about my own writing, because I had that sort of self-awareness of like, oh God, you know, now I've read whatever it is. This is terrible. So I think my standards got higher through kind of learning, and then, but the procrastination would kick in. But yeah, the starting is horrendous, and I had real imposter syndrome. I think because, you know, I have this real thing about that I didn't go to that I'm not Oxbridge and I'm surrounded by people who did. And I had to talk to my friend about it for ages, and he was like, who did do English at Cambridge? So I was like, well, obviously I'm going to defer to everything. And he was like, he said, but what you have to understand is I did English at Cambridge, yes, but you're more creative than me.
Yeah.
Like, you just are. From all our conversations, spending time together, you have more ideas than me. And I could quote Virgil, but I actually think you have better ideas than me. And it was like, I don't know, it was like a real unlocking or something.
Yeah, you need friends to remind you of that stuff, because you can lose sight of your how others see you.
Yeah.
And especially if, like us, you think everything you do is terrible. And
yeah, and I've always been arty, and I thought actually, like, clinging onto that artistry is, it's different. It's a different skill to, like, studying a medieval poet and doing a dissertation on them. So I was able to sort of go, it's okay, I just have to focus on what I'm good at, and that's still valid.
Oh, Katie, look at that dog. What is it? It's a grey
cloud, isn't it?
Do you know, I've loved our walk.
Yeah,
haven't you enjoyed
too.
It? What do you think of Raymond, Katie?
I think he's adorable. I could really see me with a Raymond. I just don't think it will practically work, but I feel really quite jealous that you get like a toy to play with every day.
Well, what about if you sometimes, would you like to maybe borrow him sometimes?
Yeah, I'd love that. And take him round Peckham Rye. Oh, you heard that, didn't you, Raymond? You heard that you were going to have a godmum.
Oh, would you? Maybe you could be Raymond's godmother.
I'd love that.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that. And do remember to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.